wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Ellen.
Millie, I think the listeners can hear your smile.
They always say I'm about to crack up in my news reads as well, and I'm like, oh no. Yeah, ear to ear today.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's first day of semester.
I know. Welcome back, everybody.
Yeah. Work hard, for goodness sake, because it's going to be October. Before you know it, those exams are going to be here. So start as you mean to go on. That's my advice.
Exactly. Well, everyone in your class will be well behaved, eh, Ellen?
They'd better be. All three of them. Jeez.
So you three better be on your best.
Yeah, I'll notice if you're not there. Yeah.
Exactly. But they might be at the new Oppenheimer movie.
Yeah, we're going to talk movies today. Yeah. Science at the movies.
Science at the movies.
And my kind of science.
And we're not talking Barbie.
No,
sorry.
Next week.
Sorry. Well, yeah, I'm sure Davide would be, yep, he'll be into that. let's talk Oppenheimer, because there's a big movie coming out on Thursday, I think.
Yeah.
Thursday or Friday. Mm-hmm. All about this guy Oppenheimer. And, okay, be honest, you two, had you heard the name before the movie?
No.
Okay, Millie, be honest.
Vaguely.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Very, very interesting. So let's talk about him then. And why is he getting a movie made about him, I guess, is the big thing. And you said your favourite sort of science is science in the movies. I'm struggling to think of too many sort of movie biographies of people. There's Turing. They made that movie about Alan Turing. Who else have we got?
There's like the Stephen Hawking one as well, isn't there?
Yes,
beautiful.
Stephen Hawking. Okay, so what's in common with those two? You know, it's not just your sort of straight science story, is it? You know, one was gay before it was allowed, and the other one had dear old, was it muscular dystrophy or whatever? And you know, so tragic, you know, kind of tragic tales. And this one also, Oppenheimer, is a tragic tale as well. I don't think anybody's made a movie about Einstein.
We need a Marie Curie movie. Someone get on that.
Yeah, actually, that's a very good idea. I'm not sure whether there is. I don't know. But anyway, let's talk Oppenheimer. So he was born in 1904 and died in the 60s, 1967. And, you know, as you might expect, he did really, really well at school. And so he went to Harvard and he majored in, yay, chemistry.
Woo!
Woohoo. But then he went on to be a theoretical physicist because apparently he was a bit of a klutz in the lab. So you can't really be a chemist if you're going around dropping stuff and everything like that. So
Unavailable.
He was better with numbers than he was with equipment, shall we say. And so he did his undergraduate at Harvard. And then, as some people do, they go on to do a PhD. So he went to Cambridge, wanted to do a PhD at Cambridge, wanted to work for Rutherford, yay, Rutherford said no.
Aww, Ernest.
So he ended up working for a while with Rutherford's old boss, who was a guy by the name of J.J. Thompson. Cool. And then he thought, nah, this isn't quite for me. And so he sort of up sticks and he went to Göttingen in Germany, University of Göttingen, which was a real centre of physics in the 1920s, which is when this was. And he did his PhD there with a guy by the name of Max Born, who is Olivia Newton-John's grandfather. I wonder if they'll say that in the movie. Anyway, so he gets his PhD, and he's a bright young thing. He gets his PhD at the age of 23, for goodness sake.
Gosh.
I know. And so he's really, really good. So he gets a job at both, for goodness sake, Caltech and Berkeley.
Jeez.
Yeah. So he's obviously stellar. And so then he does some really great physics in the 1930s. And he's sort of he's everywhere. He's doing all sorts of stuff. He hasn't got one sort of specialty. He's all over the place. Plus, he's also what you would call a polymath. Probably. He knew a lot about absolutely everything, not necessarily just science and physics and stuff like that. So, for example, he read the Hindu religious text in Sanskrit, for goodness sake. So he taught himself Sanskrit and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So he was really, really a jack of all trades.
Better than us.
Sounds like he didn't have many friends. So he had a lot of spare time.
Well, extramarital affairs and, yeah, so he had friends, yeah. Okay.
Was he good at parties?
That'll make for a good movie.
So, and okay, so far, so boring, really. And then Second World War broke out, obviously. And the Americans were a couple of years late getting into that one, you know. But obviously, they were worried about the fact that the Germans could be looking at making an atomic bomb. And so the thing to do with that was to obviously have a program of their own to make an atomic bomb. And so this was led by, militarily, by a guy named Leslie Groves. So he was a major in the US Army. He basically was the man that organized everything, and he was the one that got Oppenheimer on board. Okay, right. So he's the one that employed Oppenheimer to be the head of this, quote, secret weapons laboratory.
Okay.
And, you know, they chose him because he was not just your ordinary scientist, that he had that sort of experience and was well-read and wide-ranging and everything like that. So, and he was an excellent scientist to boot, obviously, as you kind of had to be. So, now, when Oppenheimer came back from Europe after he finished his PhD, he went and caught tuberculosis, TB, which is a bit nasty, so he had to go and recuperate out in the good old American Wild West in New Mexico. And he really, really liked it there, and he ended up buying a farm out there. Then, when the Second World War broke out and he was going to be in charge of these secret weapons, they needed a secret place so that they could do all this stuff in secret. And he said, how about New Mexico? It's nice out there, blah, blah, blah. Let's go to a little place called Los Alamos. And so they started the lab at Los Alamos, which is just down the road from his farm. And so, long story short, he was in charge of the team, and the team, I think, was around about 6,000 people.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. Who eventually came up with the first atomic bomb. And July the 16th, 1945, was the first successful test of an atomic bomb, and the world changed irrevocably on that day, obviously. So, again, so far, so... not boring, but, you know, so far so middle of the road. But when he saw that first bomb explode, he went back to the Sanskrit, one of the Hindu religious works, and there was a phrase from that, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." And that's what he thought about that. And essentially from that moment on, he was not a fan of nuclear technology or nuclear weapons, shall we say.
Okay, oh, cool. Fair enough.
And so after the war, he went to Princeton, and he had this sort of place where all these really, really intelligent people would come and just discuss things and problems and stuff like that. And then in the early 1950s, then that's where the trouble came, because back in the 1930s, he'd been one of these nice sort of left-leaning sort of people who, you know, believed in socialism, stuff like that, and he had some friends who were communists, and there's queries over whether he was a communist as well, etc., etc., etc. And then somebody dug this up, and he got hauled before the Un-American Activities Committee. And
drama.
Again, long story short, in 1954 he had his security clearance revoked, for goodness sake. And it was never reinstated in his lifetime. And this is probably why they made the movie about him, because probably solely because of that, okay? And so he sort of spent the last years of his life sort of having been shunned by his country. Kennedy tried to rehabilitate him a couple of years before his death, but it took until December last year for his security clearance revocation to be itself revoked.
Too late.
Just a touch. So that's what you can expect in this movie. Those are sort of the facts, and now you can sort of see why he would warrant a movie about himself. The Cold War, it just was a ridiculous time, you know. Yeah. All of the stuff about, you know, Reds under the bed and the communist scare and McCarthyism and all of that stuff.
It's quite surreal in a way.
Well, our current world is quite surreal. I mean, goodness me, we've got two European nations at war with each other, you know. It's crazy. Why are people so stupid?
It's amazing that they had that many scientists working towards something that isn't necessarily amazing.
Well, it is, but that's the thing. Amazing. It's what it's used for. That's
exactly,
not, you know.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, the genie is out of the bottle there. You can't ever put it back in. So, you know, as humanity, we've just got to be a little bit more sensible, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. And there's some more science you want to discuss that we've been using. Wasn't necessarily great.
Yeah, no, well, this is interesting. Okay, so those of you who are listeners to the mainstream media might have heard that if you drink diet cola drinks, for example, not naming any names, you might be considering stopping that because they have found that the artificial sweetener aspartame may or may not cause cancer. Okay, so this is just nuts. Okay, so little background. So the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IRAC. So last week, and they are part of the World Health Organization, okay?
Yeah.
So last week they came out with a pronouncement and quote unquote, aspartame is possibly carcinogenic to humans. Possibly. Yikes. Okay, so possibly is the big word there. Now, on the same day, for goodness sake.
Oh, no.
Same day. So we had the Joint Food and Agriculture Organization World Health Expert Committee on Food Additives. And they came out and they said that there is no convincing evidence, quote, for harm below 40 milligrams per kilogram per day of aspartame. That's the currently accepted level.
Is that quite a bit?
That was set. No. It's not a lot at all. In order to get that, 70 kilogram person would have to drink 14 and a half cans of whatever your favorite fizzy drink is.
Oh, that's quite a lot.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. Okay, and you'd have to be doing that regularly. Okay. I remember there was a story about this woman down in Invercargill that was drinking 10 2-litre bottles of Diet Coke a day and ended up
Well, if you're doing that
dying.
Every day, then cancer's not really your only worry. Yeah.
Therein lies the problem because, okay, now this will make you laugh. So the IRAC, so this International Cancer Agency, okay, they've only got four possibilities. Okay, they've got four possible outcomes when somebody gives them a compound for them to test, okay? So what they've got is carcinogenic to humans, probably carcinogenic to humans, possibly carcinogenic to humans, and not classifiable as to its carcinogenicity to humans.
Oh, that is about as vague as it gets.
Exactly, yeah. So what they've gone is for number three on that list, possibly.
Right.
Not probably, but possibly, okay? Now, what they think might happen, they found an increased risk, a very slightly increased risk of a particular type of liver cancer, okay? Mm-hmm. And so they specified that, yeah, their evidence is limited. It is limited. And they can't rule out other factors. So as you were saying, you know, so there are other lifestyle factors that have not been taken into account in this. You know, if you're drinking 14 cans of aspartame-laced whatever a day, you're probably doing something else wrong as well. Yeah, exactly. So, so where does that leave everybody? Because this has been widely put out in the mainstream media.
I must admit, I was a little worried. I used to be a big Diet Coke girl.
Ooh,
and
okay.
And
now you're not.
I'm scared.
More rum, less Coke, Millie. There you go.
Well, I can do that.
But where does that leave us? We have two World Health Organizations basically saying conflicting things. One saying possibly cancerous. Other ones saying, as long as you stick to below 40 milligrams per kilogram of body weight per day, then you're okay. There's no evidence for any nasties at that level, okay? Mm. So what do you do? And then, so people, one of the reasons for drinking diet sodas is because they don't want to drink the full sugar stuff because you get fat.
Yeah. Okay?
And so the World Health Organization has said that, no, that's in fact not the case, that it's a not very effective way of avoiding weight gain.
You're kidding me.
No. So the quote, the long-term consumption of diet drinks for weight loss is not effective, unquote.
Wow.
So, seems to me, well, it seems to them anyway, this is what they mentioned. You've got three choices. You either drink the sugar drink, you drink the aspartame sweetened drink, or just drink bloody water.
And just drink water, guys.
Moral of the story, just drink water.
Yeah.
So, we're going to leave that one up in the air, folks, because, you know, and that's not a good place to leave it, because as you say, people are going to be concerned about this. Now, should they be concerned? And that's a question that really nobody's got the answer to.
Because apparently stress is bad for your health as well.
Yep.
So now it's diet drinks and stress.
So, yeah, interesting. And I think Millie might be doing an undercover expose of this, I think.
Yeah, it was a hard one. I reached out to a lot of people regarding this topic this morning. I actually wanted to do an interview to follow this. But people, because it's so in the grey, people don't want to come forward and say anything concrete.
Yep, and I guess you can hardly blame them.
I can hardly blame them now you've explained it.
Well, I've tried, but yeah. So a really, really interesting story, but it's just hasn't got a nice denouement.
Yeah, no.
But
we've found some concrete science. Found a safe, easy, affordable way to store and retrieve hydrogen. Did I make that sound as exciting as I could?
Yeah, very, very, very quickly. God, I've got my blah, blah, blah today. Very, very quickly. So, hydrogen. So, if we're going to use hydrogen as an alternative to, you know, our fossil fuels, how do we store it and transport it? That's the big thing. So, hydrogen comes basically in cylinders. And cylinders are big, bulky, they're under high pressure, they're not very easy to move around, etc., etc. And we can't easily liquefy hydrogen because it boils at too low a temperature. So turning the gas into a liquid would be a good idea, but no, you need to keep it so cold. So a bunch of workers in Japan have said, well, instead of worrying about how to store hydrogen, let's worry about how to store ammonia, because ammonia is made of 20% hydrogen. And if we could store ammonia effectively, then we could use that as a proxy for hydrogen. We can easily convert ammonia to hydrogen, and you know, this might be a good way. So they're using a substance called a perovskite, and they have found that at room temperature and pressure you can put ammonia into this perovskite, and it gobbles up the ammonia and it reacts with it, and it's all nice and stable, and it just sucks it up and it just sits there and looks at you at room temperature and pressure. And then when you want to get it out, all you've got to do is heat it to 50 degrees and it comes back out. So
it's beautiful.
You've got this thing that now can accommodate a lot of ammonia, importantly at room temperature and at atmospheric pressure. We don't have to use big cylinders. We don't have to use high pressures, all of that sort of stuff. You don't have to liquefy things. And all that it takes is a little bit of heat at the end of it to get that ammonia back out. And you can bet your bottom dollar they'll be doing lots and lots and lots of work on this, because that looks a pretty effective way of storing and transporting hydrogen.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So there we go. There's science for the week, I think.
Thank you so much. That was a happy ending. Quite a ride there. Thank you, science. Thank you, Ellen.
And thank you, MoTat.
Yeah, and thank you, MoTat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.